The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Is BP contaminating your portfolio? We assess the oil spill's effect on the share price and dividend. Who needs a financial advisor? We find even more investors going it alone. And who's moving into new build property? We look at new developments in the housing market. All this to come in this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Alice Ross.
Hello.
And Tanya Poley.
Hello.
And our special studio guest, Rebecca O'Keefe, Head of Investments at Interactive Investor.
Hello.
So let's start with the money news. This week, shares in BP fell to their lowest level since 1997 as US criticism of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill intensified. On Thursday, fears that President Obama would impose massive financial penalties on the company sent the share price plummeting 12% at the start of trading to 345 pence. That's nearly half the level BP shares were trading at before the oil spill began on the 20th of April. Reports that the US Justice Department is planning to force BP to withhold its next dividend payment and suggestions that compensation costs are spiralling out of control have hit UK pension funds and income funds hard. BP currently provides £1 in every £7 worth of dividends that pension funds receive from FTSE 100 companies. Alice, how important then is BP to all of our pensions?
Well, it's important. I mean, it's a big holding in most pension funds for the reasons that you say. It's just such a massive dividend payer on the FTSE 100. And especially since the fall of the banks a couple of years ago, they stopped paying dividends. So a lot of people have gone into BP as one of the biggest dividend payers. So there are a lot of holdings in BP. I would say, though, that the impact is going to be worse on the income funds this year than the pension funds. Because remember that pension fund investing is for the long term. So, you know, the pension funds have 10, 20, 30 years to recover from this. And there's been no talk as yet of BP, going under or anything suspending its dividend for the long term. What we're talking about at the moment is a Q2 suspension of the dividend. So the impact on pension funds is probably not as concerning as the impact this year for income investors.
And I suppose the thing about pension funds is that they are diversified across different asset classes, whereas your average, say, UK equity income fund is just holding the big FTSE 100 dividend payers. And I think BP is the largest holding, isn't it, for more than half of all income funds? Is that about right?
Yeah, well, we ran the figures recently, and so there are 86 UK equity income funds, and BP is the top holding in 40 of those. So almost
under
half. Yeah,
okay.
Just under half. Yeah. 63 of them have holdings in BP, and some of them have as much as 10% of their holdings in BP. That might not sound so much, but if you think that 10% of the shares are in BP, but BP is likely to be a bigger dividend payer. So if it does suspend its dividend, as apparently the market is now pricing in to the shares that the market expects it to suspend its dividend, then that will have an impact on the kind of income that you can get from these funds this year.
Now, I was very interested to hear from a UK growth fund manager earlier this week that he has started buying BP. Now, obviously, growth fund managers are not looking for dividends, so he's probably quite happy that BP isn't going to pay any. But he's buying in just because he thinks the share price has fallen so far that it's an overreaction and it's got to recover. Is anyone else of that opinion?
A lot of people are of that opinion, particularly private investors have been snapping up BP shares. It's for the past 7 days, I think, or 10 days, BP buys on a lot of trading platforms have been the top one or the top five or the top 10. And Rebecca, I think that you've been seeing that on your share platform, that a lot of investors are actually buying BP, not for the dividend, not for the income, but just because they think it's very cheap now.
They do think it's very good value, and they're probably right at these levels. I mean, most investments should be for the long term, but we do find short-term speculators are very interested in oil stocks in general. BP hasn't typically been their radar because it's been too big a stock to own, and you've typically had smaller oil stocks that have been far more volatile and far more actively traded. However, BP has come into the radar of many investors who, albeit may not be looking for dividend income, would still be interested in the UK government taking more of an active interest and considering what they're going to do, because many investors are looking at this in some horror, with the US government seemingly telling UK Investment PLC what they can or can't do. So I think you've got a huge number of different variables when it comes to BP at the moment, the dividend being one element of it. But as it is, as a growth stock for the next 2, 4, 5 years, it looks a pretty good bet for a lot of our investors. And we are seeing buys to sells in the range of sort of 4 to 1.
Which ties in with what I've been hearing from other brokers. Just very, very quickly, should pension investors have anything to worry about? Should they do anything, or should they just sit tight?
You can't really do it. When it's your pension and when it's just a kind of a flash fear like this, with one stock as well, there's not much you can do. I mean, just remember 2 years ago when, you know, we had all of those problems in October 2008 with the markets. Markets went hugely down. That did affect pension investors then, but pensions have recovered a lot, and that was the entire market, not just one stock. So I don't think pension investors should be too concerned.
Thanks, Alice. And for the latest on BP and on new equity income funds focusing on Asia and Latin America rather than the UK or US, look out for the articles in FT Money with this weekend's FT and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, would you buy a new build home to live in or to let out? First, though, using financial advisors, or rather, not using financial advisors. Last week, a survey found that nearly half of all investors now managed all of their money themselves, and 9 out of 10 managed some of their own portfolios. This week, further evidence of this trend has emerged. The Investment Management Association has revealed that more than a third of all fund investments are made direct over online platforms rather than through financial advisors. And the pension provider AJ Bell reported that 73% of the 500,000 people who now manage their own pensions monitor their individual holdings on a weekly basis. Alice, DIY really seems to be gaining in popularity.
It really does, and there's a few reasons for that. Firstly, there's kind of the long-term trend, probably over the past decade or so, whereby finding out information about stocks as a private investor has just become so much more easy with the advent of the internet. Investors have such an advantage now. They can just look up stock prices. They can access all of this research. And online trading platforms have sprung up to allow them to just make buys and sells without any need for a financial advisor. So that has been this kind of long-term trend. But this seems to have been hastened in the past 18 months, past 2 years, by the credit crunch, which saw so many investors lose so much money that a lot of them, whether rightly or wrongly, blamed their financial advisor. And this seems to have turned them towards managing their portfolios more themselves, turning to online stockbrokers, execution-only services. And I think, Rebecca, that's a trend that you've definitely noticed in the past 18 months or so, isn't it?
We have. I mean, in terms of share dealing, the number of share trades that were done on our platform over the last sort of 18 months has increased threefold, which is an indication just generally of how many people are taking a more active interest. Mm. I mean, the shift from advised to sort of self-directed individuals is for a variety of reasons. For many, it is about making an active decision. It's the availability of information, tools, resources, and the simple fact that buying your own investments is actually a reasonably cheap thing to do. It's cost effective. For some, they've become forced investors as there's been a shift from defined benefit to defined contribution schemes. So whether they like it or not, they've suddenly had to take a much more active interest in their own financial future. But to be honest, receiving a 6-monthly statement which shows that your future plans are going up in smoke because your returns kept going down was probably the nail in the coffin for a number of people with their financial advisors. And they made the decision to actively manage the money themselves because, to be honest, who is going to do sort of review your portfolio regularly sort of and take much more of an interest? It's going to be you. You're the person that has the vested interest in making sure that your finances are in the right place. So for that reason, we have sort of lots of people who are looking to manage the money themselves for their own financial future.
And why? What, I mean, financial advisors often come under criticism for this, that they only provide 6-monthly or yearly portfolio statement updates. They only review your finances every year. Should we blame them for that? Is that? Could they be snappier with their investment decisions, or is that just the nature of the game with a financial advisor?
I think it's difficult. I mean, most clients only get a triennial review, but they get 6-monthly statements. So that's a review every 3 years with statements every 6 months. It is difficult for a financial advisor to really be good at everything. I mean, for me, the financial advisor market is much more about investment planning and tax planning rather than investment planning. So it's tax planning and sort of protection and trusts and inheritance tax. And they can't necessarily be good at the investment choices. It's also the fact that there is not a huge informational advantage with financial advisors. Most retail investors have as much information at their fingertips as a financial advisor would. So it is much better probably to actually, if you're comfortable looking at after your own investments, to start thinking about what you should do yourself.
But as you were saying, there are some areas where private investors don't have the advantage over financial advisors, and that might be areas of tax planning, inheritance tax, that are a little bit more complicated, and that's where you probably should consider a financial advisor?
I think you should. I mean, for the very high net worth, you've certainly got IHT planning, trusts, and general taxation matters. For a general audience, you've got protection and basic tax planning. But for a lot of people in the middle, you have the ability and the resources to do it yourself. And even if you're allowing your financial advisor to give you general advice about what you should be considering, the actual underlying investment side of things might be good.
I think that's very good advice. I wouldn't try and do any of those things myself. They're just far too complicated, I think. Thanks very much for that, Rebecca and Alice. And for more on what you can do yourself and what you might want to take advice on, look out for Alice's article in FT Money this weekend and online at ft.com/money. And finally today, new build property. At the height of the housing market boom, 7 out of 10 newly built homes in Britain were being snapped up by investors rather than owner-occupiers. But after a credit crunch, financial crisis and recession, that proportion has nearly halved. But this week, there were signs that investors may be returning. Tanya, who is buying new builds today?
Well, I think if we're looking at the prime London market, it seems to be predominantly international investors again. We have seen an increase of international investors coming back into the new build market up from last year. So like last year was about maybe 30% of the proportion was actually investors compared to owner occupiers. And now we're up to like sort of 41% again. And it actually does seem to be predominantly Asian investors. They're the ones who seem to be particularly like new build properties rather than, say, you know, the second hand properties, normal kind of properties.
So while UK investors are looking to Asian equity markets for their dividends, because they don't want to get them from BP or anything like that, we have Asian investors buying into property in London and other parts of the UK, or is it just London?
It's mainly London. I think before, say, the peak of market, international investors were kind of buying new build properties across the UK, but now the focus does primarily seem to be on London. I mean, I think with Asian investors, we're seeing that it's again a matter of the fact that there's like they've got favourable exchange rates at the moment. So, say, compared to the peak of market, they're getting discounts of between 30-50% on London prime property. Also, they kind of see London very much as a safe haven at the moment. Particularly in terms of property purchases. So I think that's kind of been the main drive that we're seeing, like, Asian investors actually come into the London market.
That does explain why London might look more attractive, because I suppose the prime London market we have seen in price terms be incredibly robust and prices going up, which presumably must make yields less attractive unless you have this currency factor.
Yeah, I mean, well, over the last, I would say about 18 months now, we've seen prime property prices go up by about sort of nearly a quarter. So actually, it's like it's providing a very strong market. But a few people have said to me, actually, the new build property market hasn't kind of risen as much, but they're kind of predicting that that's going to follow quite shortly. It already is sort of seeing gains. I know a lot of people are kind of predicting like sort of next year and the year after that it's going to be quite substantial gains, like 7%, and then following that, maybe 10%. So really, the Asian investors realise that they're onto a good sort of investment, particularly from a capital gain. From a yield perspective, they're unlikely to see anything more than 5% in the London market. But a lot of these Asian investors particularly, find London quite attractive because a lot of their kids are studying over here. So they kind of do it, first of all, for them to kind of, have a good base. And they like new builds because often they're like very good on security, light sense point of view. They're easy to let out. They kind of provide that sort of safeness, I think, for their kids. And after that, income yields are likely to kind of go up in the future as kind of capital growth sort of doesn't continue too much, like in the long term. So it's going to provide quite a good investment opportunity for them.
And are there any particular developments or sort of buildings in London that have proved particularly attractive?
Yes, there's one called the Pan Peninsula, which is in Canary Wharf. I think that's been particularly attractive for Asian investors. It seems to me that they particularly like anywhere that's near a sort of central tube station, anywhere that kind of just sort of has a kind of feeling of being very prime London and attractive from that point of view.
And just finally, what does this mean for those of us who might be trying to buy a new build property? Presumably there are fewer of them, or the prices are going up, by the week.
Yeah, it does have the aspect that it's actually making it a bit more unaffordable for sort of local buyers to actually buy a new build property. But at the moment, I mean, with new build property, UK buyers and European buyers seem to be a bit kind of still unsure. I mean, it was hit quite hard by the credit crunch, and there were all these problems with valuations and fraud. So I think a lot of UK buyers are kind of sitting back and not too keen to touch new build. But in the long run, I mean, this is going to obviously help the house builders and developers kind of maybe, obviously prices are going up, so they're going to be able to afford to build more properties. So in the long run, when people are a bit more sure about new build, actually, there's going to be more properties on offer.
So it could be good in the long run for all of us. Tanya, we'll obviously keep monitoring that. And if you'd like to know more about new build property, you can read Tanya's article in FT Money with this weekend's FT. That's all we have time for on this week's FT Money Show. Remember, you can find weekday news updates and all of these stories on our website, ft.com/money. And you can now find all of our interactive web content brought together in one place on our brand new Money Matters page. You'll find our latest blog posts, columns that you can comment on, beginner's guides, top tips, and details of our live Q&A sessions, including the recent Q&A on gold. So send in your questions, comments and thoughts by visiting ft.com/moneymatters. We'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form, but until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Alice, Tanya and our special guest Rebecca O'Keefe from Interactive Investor.
Goodbye. Bye.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost £27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.